All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, warrant officer, CW2 type, helicopter pilot, Vietnam in 1969. And here we are here again on Veterans Radio, what we like to think of as the voice of America's veterans. And we've got a really interesting program for you today. It's a story about Ivan Castro. And Ivan was on our program back in September, and he'd written a book called Fighting Blind. And he talked about, in the book, and we're going to play part of an interview for you, he was a Green Beret who was wounded in Iraq and lost his sight, but he's still active in the military. And so that's the big part of the story, is how do you come back from being blinded and continue moving on in your career with the Army and in the Special Forces. So it's kind of a really cool story. So we want to make sure that you stick around and listen to that. We're going to be playing part of the interview that we did in September. And then in the second half of the program, Ivan is going to be joining us again to tell us about exactly what he has been doing since his injury. So I think it's really a compelling story, and I strongly encourage you to stick around. We want to thank our sponsors, of course, for keeping Veterans Radio going on the air. That's Legal Help for Veterans, American House, and Calhoun Mortgage up in Howell. And we want to make sure that you can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and Twitter. The other quick announcement is that we are looking for veterans who served in Vietnam during the Tet Offensive of 1968. We're doing a program commemorating the 50th anniversary. Wow, the 50th anniversary of the Tet Offensive on Sunday, February 4th. So we're looking for people who were there and could, you know, would be willing to share their stories with our audience. If you want to be on the program on February 4th, please contact us during through our website. That's veteransradio.net. I got two quick announcements for you. Coming up next week, on Saturday, January 27th at Chrysler Center at the University of Michigan, we've got the annual U.S. Army-Navy wheelchair basketball game. Now, this is a fundraiser, and we want everybody to go if you can. This is going to be at 5 p.m. at the Chrysler Center. And as I mentioned before, it's Army-Navy wheelchair basketball game. The musical entertainment is going to be there, the U of M dance team, the U of M cheerleading team, and the 338th band. And by the way, admission is free for this. And if you need any help getting in there, you should go to this website, wheelchairbasketball.umich.edu. That's wheelchairbasketball.umich.edu. This is always a fun event. A lot of veterans are there. And, of course, it's for a great cause. So it's U of M Army versus Navy wheelchair basketball game next Saturday, January 27th at the Chrysler Center. Tip-off is at 5 p.m. Be there. All right, the other thing that's coming up, and that's on Sunday, January 28th, is the Fallen Heroes Memorial Foundation is having a fundraiser to build a memorial in Oakland County to honor the 18 military service members who have made the ultimate sacrifice during the War on Terror. What the Lest They Be Forgotten Memorials are built to honor and remember the service and sacrifice of our military fallen heroes. So they're having a fundraiser next Sunday morning, and it runs from 8 o'clock until 11 a.m., and it's going to be at the Peace Lutheran Church on Elizabeth Lake Road, just east of William Lakes Road in Waterford, from 8 until 11. As I mentioned, the cost is $10, and this is going to go to build a memorial to the fallen heroes of Oakland County. And I think that this is a very interesting and a very worthwhile event. So if you want more information, you can call the Peace Lutheran Church. Their number is 248-681-9360, or you can call Skip Bushart at 248-245-7653. That's next Sunday, January 28th. It's the Fallen Heroes Memorial. It's called Lest They Be Forgotten, 8 to 11 at Peace Lutheran Church in Waterford. All right, so we're going to take a real quick break right now. When we come back, we've got our interview with Ivan Castro. His book is entitled Fighting Blind. It's a story of extraordinary courage, and I hope that you enjoy it. Stick around, and I'll be back here at the bottom of the hour. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and joining me on the line right now is Captain Ivan Castro. Ivan is in the United States Army, and Ivan, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Good afternoon, Dale. How are you?
I'm terrific. Thank you so much for being on the program. I know you've been flying all over the country.
I have. I just touched down right now. As a matter of fact, I'm sitting at the airport.
Well, thank you for giving us this time. I just think it's so important to get your story out. I know it has been out for a while, but maybe our audience doesn't know about it, and it's something that they should. So I know that you were in Dayton this weekend. Did you run another full marathon?
I did. I was. It was an honor to have been invited to the Air Force Marathon as they celebrate their 70th anniversary as a force, and wow, what a celebration, you know. I can tell you that everybody came out in force, the town of Dayton and nearby towns, and from all branches of service and from all corners of the U.S. and around the world came to run that marathon. It was just a great event. And yes, I was a guest speaker for the pasta dinner and for the expo, and since I was there, I said, hey, I've already ran this marathon, I think, four times. Let's run it one more time and celebrate their birthday by running it. It was outstanding.
You know, running a marathon for some people is not a big deal. For those of us who don't run at all, it is a very big deal. And I think, again, I congratulate you for participating in that. The unusual part of this, of course, is that you were blind.
I am. I've been blind for the last 11 years. As a matter of fact, on September 2nd,
right,
I just hit my, I call it my alive day, and it's 11 years now.
And you are still on active duty?
No, sir. I just retired. As we say, I faced out, taking me, and I'm drinking water now. And believe it, I retired as a major, and always grateful for the support that my command and my peers were there for me and my family the entire time.
Well, it is a great story, and so I wanted to kind of start it off with, how did you get into the military in the first place?
You know, I come from a family who serves. My brother, uncle, cousins, and my brother served in the Marines, and I just wanted to serve my country. And I always teased my brother. I told him I had to do a step up, so I told him I joined the Army. And you know, those are fighting words when you tell that to a Marine or any other branch of service.
That's true.
But as always, to my brother, we always like to tease each other. But at the end of the day, it's all one team, one fight. And joined the military and as an enlisted after 4 years of college at the University of Puerto Rico, and went to the 101st, was in Rock-a-Sons, and went to Desert Storm, Desert Shield, and then I moved on to a Pathfinder detachment there in the 101st. Then from there, I moved on to 5th Corps Lurs in Germany, Darmstadt, Germany, and I had the opportunity to deploy twice to Bosnia and Albania and Kosovo, and from there I went to Ranger Regiment. I was in 3rd Ranger Battalion at Fort Benning, Georgia, and a drill sergeant there at Sand Hill for infantry. And then I came to Special Forces, 7th Special Forces Group. I made it all the way to E7 and put my packet in for OCS, and was very blessed and fortunate that I was selected to go to OCS and got commissioned and went to the 82nd.
Well, you had some. As we know, since you're running marathons still, you're a pretty competitive guy.
Always. And always giving 100%. That's what they teach us, right?
That's very true. And it, you ran, you know, you had some interesting escapades, I guess you could say, as you were making your way through the enlisted ranks and trying to get into schools and taking care of other people and staying out of trouble and so on and so forth. And so it wasn't an easy task to do all these schools that you went to.
You know, I never turned down an opportunity for any school. There were times that some guys just had no desire to go to school, or they thought it was, you know, too tough, or they wasn't sure. And regardless, whatever it was, I decided I'll give it a shot and give it 100%. even if it was field sanitation, even digging slit trenches back, you know, early on. So, whatever school it was, I guess, people, you know, I always say I was in the right place at the right time, I guess, when it was offered.
Well, you worked your way up through the ranks of getting more and more elite units as you continued on with your career, and, you know, ended up with the special forces, with a Ranger tab. You were a jumper, all those things, correct?
I was, yeah. I went to a lot of skill set schools, and what I always saw is, what can I do to benefit the unit and my team? How can I, you know, get a skill that would benefit the unit and make it mission ready, you know, always. And, you know, and then as a leader, and I look to encourage guys to take different, you know, leadership schools as well as technical schools that would improve the readiness of the unit. You know?
I guess I never really thought about it that much because I wasn't in the service long enough. When they offered me the option to get out, I took it. But all of the different schooling and training that you've had has certainly made you more of a complete, not only just a soldier, but it certainly, as it turns out, made you officer material.
You know, I have to say, you know, from the early on, my belief is we are who we are based on our parents at an early age. We know what's right and wrong with yes and no and hot and cold. And, you know, I'm very blessed that my parents gave me some ethics, values, and morals, you know, but which is the foundation. But also, I was very blessed to have some great leaders on and guiding me through my career. Still to this day, I stay in contact, as I'm retired, with a lot of folks who mentored me and gave me the opportunity. So I was very blessed.
I agree with that. I had the privilege of meeting you about a year ago in Detroit when you were in talking about your book, and also you were out there with Bob Gillette and a number of other wounded veterans. It was a softball game, I believe, at the time, and it was really interesting to see how you navigate among regular, I don't want to say regular people, because you're a regular person too.
I am.
It's just to see how everybody really wanted to know more and more about you, because you are such an inspiring presence. And I'm not trying to, you know, gush it up too much, but it was impressive. So I guess we should jump ahead a little bit here. So you get into OCS, which is not an easy task to do as an enlisted person anyway. And you were older than everybody else.
I was older and senior. I think, you know, I had more time in service than my the commander or the first sergeant of the unit, and I was around the same age as the battalion commander. So it makes you humble, you know. You got to go back and realize your place and what you're striving for, what you're trying to achieve. And I saw it as a great opportunity to assist and be part of a team. And, you know, sometimes when you go to school, you see the cadre or the instructors, you know, on one side, and you the student as the other. And I try to bridge that together. But also, you know, when I went to OCS, we were ready in time of war. And I had already been, you know, to war and combat areas. So my focus to these young leaders were, you know, being technically and tactically proficient in combat skills, regardless of whatever their occupation skill, their military occupation skill was going to be. You know, at the end of the day, when the enemy has a U.S. soldier in their sights, it's not like, well, I'm finance or...
Right. Yeah. No.
I'm a generator mechanic. You know, we're the enemy, and you've got to be a force ready. Every branch of service, and you know, every MOS has to be ready to be an infantryman first. You know, and you know, when we join the Army, we're given a uniform and we have to qualify a weapon. And when we deploy, we have a weapon in our hands, regardless of where you're at and what branch or
what you're at. Isn't it the Marines always said, you know, that you're a grunt first?
Yep.
Whatever.
I definitely do love that about the Marines. I got to give them kudos. The Marines are always, they're a Marine first, right? And everybody's is an infantryman first, I think. Yeah.
That's for sure.
Saves lives.
What was the main difference between, or what is the main difference to you between being enlisted and being an officer?
It's sad to say, one of the main differences of enlisted and officer is, unfortunately, is the pay scale.
We're all aware of that.
I mean, you know, when I became an officer, I am going to tell you straight up, this is no lie. I was called in to my battalion commander's office, and he said, "Why do you want to become an officer?" And I pulled out a pay scale that I had in my pocket, and I said, "Look at this." And, you know, I was an E7. If I become sergeant major, you know, E9, and look at this pay rank of, you know, captain, can you see a difference? And then I just kept on going, and I said, listen, I'm not doing this for duty on our country, because I'm already doing duty on our country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm going to continue to give 100% and serve. I'm doing this for my family. And, it's very hard to go from a senior E7 to become a second lieutenant, and the first assignment is a platoon leader. And have an E7 with you, you know.
Right.
You have to realize that, hey, I have to stay in my lane and let him, you know, develop my platoon sergeant, you know. So I always said, as long as it doesn't affect limb, eyesight, or life, you know, we're going with it.
I noticed
it was hard. I was going to lie. It was hard not to be a platoon leader and a platoon sergeant at the same time.
Right. I was just going to say you had to hold yourself back, because I know that in one of the parts of the book that I really enjoyed, when you arrived in Iraq, you ran off of the plane in front of everybody, and you're supposed to let the other guys do that, I guess, and, you know, kind of hang back just for a moment, but, you know, you always wanted to be first. And that's commendable, that to be that competitive, but it's always difficult sometimes to control that competitiveness, I guess would be the term I'm looking for.
It is. You have to realize your place and remember that you're there to lead, you know.
All right. So,
but at the same time, that doesn't mean that I wasn't going to put my gun in a fight, you know.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, you were talking in the book. We're talking with retired major now, Ivan Castro, and his book is Fighting Blind, A Green Beret Story of Extraordinary Courage. We haven't gotten to, we're going to talk right now a little bit about extraordinary courage, because you deployed not only to Afghanistan, but you also deployed to Iraq, correct?
I did.
How many times were you in Iraq?
Obviously, I went to Desert Storm, Desert Shield, as a private, and then I went to Iraq, and that's when I got hurt.
Okay.
So my tour of duty in Iraq was cut short.
Yes.
Because I guess the enemy they wanted to kill us. So they tried killing me, but it didn't happen.
All right.
But they did take the life of several guys in my unit.
Yeah. You on the day you were injured, as you mentioned, September 2nd, 2006. What was the mission that you were on at that time?
We had occupied a compound. It was a Yusufiya, Iraq, and it was a thermal power plant right on the Euphrates River, and it is known as Valley of Death, and it had a lot of foreign fighters and insurgents in that area. And it was believed that they were bringing foreign fighters in and equipping them with vehicles and vests so they could go back into Baghdad and blow themselves up.
Mm-hmm.
So we were looking for these bomb makers and this their lab, you know, where they were building these things, and we did find it. So there was a power plant, and right beside it there was a container yard. And we had been in several days before, and we lost Thomas Barbieri, just great true hero, who actually lost his life by jumping in front of his platoon sergeant. And he was awarded, posthumously the Silver Star.
Right.
And then we went in, days later into the power plant, to search that area. This is a huge compound, and as the platoon leader of a sniper and scout platoon, our mission was to provide overwatch and security in, 360 of the compound. So we were up high on elevated structures in order to provide overwatch. And the day before, mortar rounds came in on one of the corners of the compound, and basically took out almost our entire mortar platoon. It killed one Sergeant Angel Mercado, and the rest of the mortar platoon was severely injured. And that night, another sniper team from another special operations unit decided they did not want to be in that corner, so they came and relocated where I was at, and I was given the order to take that position, which obviously at the time made no sense.
Right.
But I was not going to argue. I took up the position, and I was trying to strategize and plan a way to get out of there as soon as possible. And right as daylight broke, I jumped on a rooftop, told my men to pack their bags, we're going to move. And my guys, my soldiers, my snipers and scouts, they were getting off the rooftop, and I jumped on the rooftop, and I was scouting for a different position where I could put my weapons at. And right when I looked at it, I was thinking about the key words to say to my battalion commander. Your radio transmission's got to be short, sweet and to the point. I was looking for the key words I was going to use to tell my battalion commander that we were going to move. And we were going to move for several reasons. The location that we were placed in just did not provide at that time cover.
Right.
Did not provide much concealment, and we were wide open to the element. And you can imagine that. Yeah. September in Iraq, so it's pretty hot. And also, you have to realize that when you're using sniper weapons, looking through a scope at that time of day and everything, you have a lot of mirage coming up through your scope.
Oh, true. I hadn't thought of that. Yes.
Yeah. So, you could only shoot as far as you could identify and then be able to engage the target, and identify the target. And so, As I was formulating, I had the words in my mouth, and I just picked up the hand mic. I was on a knee, picked up the hand mic, brought it up to my ear. And right when I went to push the talk button, mm-hmm. First round landed off the rooftop right beside the building. And immediately I let go of the push to talk, and someone came, where did that land? And then, the next thing I did was I looked over my left shoulder to tell there were other guys from my unit,
mm-hmm.
From my battalion on the rooftop, from Alpha Company. And right as I went and looked over my left shoulder, I was screaming to tell them, yelling, get off the rooftop, jump off. The next round landed 5 feet to my left.
And that's all you remember for a long time.
That's all I remember. Obviously, I was in, what I do remember was fighting for my life. I remember, just fighting, trying to get back.
In the book, you describe it as you felt like you were in a bog or in mud or something like that, and you were trying to pull yourself out of it, even though you were unconscious for I don't even know how long, but you just were trying to keep yourself alive until you could figure out what was going to happen next.
I was. You know, and it's been 11 years, and just this last September, I finally got to talk to, you know, one of the guys that died on the rooftop, Ralph mm-hmm. Porras, Sergeant Ralph Porras. Ralph was one of my soldiers when I was the platoon leader of, in Delta Company, you know, the tow platoon, the anti-tank platoon. So I just spoke with Ralph's aunt, sister, and mom this last September 2nd.
Wow.
And that was pretty hard for me and for them. You know, I haven't spoken to this family, you know, in 11 years. So
it's difficult to do those things.
As you know, still to this day, anybody who was on that mission or on that corner in or on the rooftop, I come across them. I try to continue to piecemeal that day and the actions that happened afterwards. And just recently, one of my soldiers said that, you know, obviously my guys jumped on the rooftop immediately, back on it. You know, we were still under attack. And immediately, one of my guys, Rafael Ortiz was his name, Rafael Ortiz. He immediately was yelling, where's Lieutenant Castro?
Mm-hmm.
And I think Sergeant Octaberry, he was a platoon sergeant, said, that's him. He's right there at your feet. And he couldn't recognize me. He said, he looked at my face, and it was nothing but mm-hmm. blood, you know, and he couldn't recognize my face. I had my helmet on, but he had to really look at my body armor, which had my last name on it. And, you know, believe it or not, I still have the shell to that body at my home.
I think it's an amazing story, Ivan, and we've only got about 3 minutes before we run out of time today. I encourage people to buy this book. I know that it's coming out in paperback pretty soon. It's called Fighting Blind, A Green Beret Story of Extraordinary Courage by Ivan Castro and Jim DeVlees. And, we're not even going to get into the recovery part of it, which is unfortunately bad timing on my part. But I'd like to invite you back if we could.
Absolutely, it would be an honor to be back. Yes, sir.
I think it's just it's such a great story, and you've got a lot of words in here. We'll save the hospital half of the book for the next time, but you follow a lot of quotes in your life, and you've got a lot of sayings that kind of keep you going.
And absolutely, I've got several back there, yeah, in the book. You know, I believe the book is not only for those who served, but for everyone. You'll find yourself in the book, whether you're a mother, a father, brother, sister, and you'll see, you know, the book is also recognizes the sacrifices mm-hmm. of men and women in uniform and their families, and just how diverse our military is all around the world.
Well, you seem to be, you know, recovered as much as possible. You have a great family, it sounds like, and I'm really proud to have had the opportunity to have you on our program.
Thank you, Bill, and I look forward to coming back.
We will do that. We will do that. Thank you very much again, and I want you to go home and get some rest. You've had a long day.
Yes, sir. God bless.
Thank you very much. Thank you. All right. We were talking to Ivan Castro. This is really a great story, folks. I encourage you to go out and read this book, Fighting Blind. It doesn't make any difference, really, if you're a veteran or not, or if you've been in the military. I think this is the kind of book for anybody who's had some sort of traumatic injury to read, and because he talks about many, many of the issues that he and his family faced as he was trying to recover. And I think that's what's so important. That's the story of the human spirit in there. And we're back live on Veterans Radio. You just heard an interview that I did with Ivan Castro back in September. And right now I want to welcome back recently retired Major Ivan Castro of the United States Army. Welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale. How are you?
I'm doing really well. How are you?
I am doing outstanding.
As usual.
Thank you for having me back. Yeah.
It is my pleasure. What a positive, positive character Mr. Castro is. I really enjoy talking with him. We talked about, Ivan, in the first half of the program about what led up to the grenades and mortars and things that landed on your roof and took you out and blinded you. And what I wanted to talk today about a little bit more is your recovery and what you've been doing since then.
Yeah, well, it was a long road to recovery, and it still is. You know, I was very eager after my injury, and I thought that in a few months or weeks I was going to be done with it, but turned out that little did I know about putting together a body. And I could tell you, Dale, that it was a joint effort from Army, Air Force, Navy, Marines, Coast Guard. It was just a joint effort, and it shows just a great part of modern military medicine. So yeah, it was something that I thought I'd be in and out of a hospital. I thought blindness was it, and then I came, as I woke up in the hospital, I came to realize the other injuries that I had, the multiple injuries, and it took, you have to do one surgery, let that heal. Meanwhile, they're seeing what other surgeries they could do on your body. Let that heal, see how that comes out. Sometimes do physical, occupational therapy, physical therapy, and then just try to rehab a little bit, get some strength underneath your feet, and then move on to the next one. So, you know, I have to tell you that my family at the time and all of my medical professionals, doctors, nurses, liaisons, coordinators, I mean, it was a joint effort.
Could you kind of describe to our audience a little bit about some of the other injuries that you had other than, you know, the blindness, which was amazing?
Yeah, my nose was shattered in pieces. My cheekbone was also shattered. My right eye was nucleated. A piece of fragment went in my left that damaged the retina and the optic nerve. I had a fragment that went into my neck, and it nipped the vertebral artery, the artery that provides, you know, blood to your brain. So it nipped it, and it caused two balloons, a bilobe aneurysm. My left deltoid was ripped off, blown off. I had a open bone fracture of the left humerus. My ulnar medium nerve on my left hand was damaged. My right index finger amputated, and then, you know, collapsed lungs, pulmonary embolism, and basically, if you were to take an X-ray of my body, you could definitely see, you know, where my body armor was, because, you know, my core, I still have fragments in it, but not as much as my extremities, all my arms and my legs and my face and my neck. So, yeah.
It's just amazing that anybody could recover from all of those wounds. And as you pointed out, that the time that's involved to fix one thing at a time so that they can move on to the next one. I'm sure they prioritized what they felt was most important. And
yeah.
was this all done at Walter Reed, or did you go to Germany and then to Walter Reed, or where did you end up?
Yeah, Balad, Landstuhl, spent there about a day, and then they flew me to Walter Reed. I was in Walter Reed for a day, and then I needed some specialized surgery, and so they moved me over to Bethesda Naval Medical Center, which is the new Walter Reed now.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, in 2006, it was Bethesda Naval Medical Center, and I was the only Army guy on that ward. Everyone else was Navy or Marine.
Oh, brother.
And let me tell you, those everybody in the Navy just opened their arms and took good care of me. Although I still give them hell.
Cause right.
That's what we do. We give hell to each other, but yeah. And, but everybody took great care of me there. Yeah. And I mean, I visited every department minus labor and delivery and OBGYN. I mean, I hit them all.
That sounds like it. In your book, you talk about some of the people that helped you out. You have one story about a particular physical therapist who you described as kind of being an Amazon woman who took care of you and was more like a drill sergeant.
Oh, yeah. She came in the first day of physical therapy. The first day of physical therapy was basically standing on my feet.
Mm-hmm.
So I had lost a ton of muscle because I was in I was heavily sedated. So I was on a ventilator and everything. And so laying in bed for so long, I lost a lot of muscle in my legs. So my first session of physical therapy was putting a belt around me and three people standing me up for about 2 seconds. And I just couldn't do it. I just broke out in a sweat in 2 seconds. And I sat back down. And then my second session of physical therapy, the physical therapist grabbed me. She was huge. God bless her. And she put a belt around me. She picked me up. And she sat me. It was like standing on my feet and turning around and sitting in a wheelchair. And she walked out the door. And I remember, my wife and I, we were looking at each other and like, you know, obviously I use the term look, but you know, I was like asking my wife, is this woman coming back? And it was like, she went down the hallway. She went to our office and she was on a computer typing some notes. I said, hey, are you coming back to do physical therapy on my husband? And she said, no, I'm done. And he said, you left him in the wheelchair. You didn't put him back in bed. And I'm like, yeah, you guys figure it out.
Oh.
And she came back and told me that. And I was like, what? I'm not going to get to the bed. And man, I tell you what, between my wife and I, we did it. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was. It was a true kick in the buttocks. You know, that was the first, my first session of physical therapy, but you know, I look back and, I'm truly grateful for the
sure.
men and women who work in these, clinics and these hospitals. And, you know, they do miracles. They do.
They do. I think you're kind of one of the, you know, the living miracles that are out there. And I know that there are many, many more because of the improvements in medical care that our soldiers, you know, can get so quickly off the battlefield that there are so many of you that are surviving that, you know, 50 years ago probably would not have.
Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. Back then it was taboo to put a tourniquet on a limb, and that's the first thing you do just to stop the bleeding, you know?
Mm-hmm. Wow. All right. So how long were you in Bethesda before you got out of there?
I think I was there. Let me see. I was there for about 4 months, and then I was released because at that time it was over your Christmas break, and everybody was taking Christmas break, and I just needed to heal a little bit from my surgeries in order to do some more. And I remember leaving there and going down to Augusta, Georgia, to start a little bit of blind rehabilitation at the VA center there.
Okay.
Right. But then I did that for about 3 months, 2 to 3 months, and then I went back up to Bethesda for more surgeries. So it's been ongoing. I mean, still to this day, you know, I have to take care of my right socket because I don't have an eye there, and,
mm-hmm.
and it's prone to infection, and I think that's about it, you know. But I've done over 50 surgeries. I lost track of how many surgeries it just all blends in.
Well, tell me how you got involved in running marathons. This is in our previous interview. You had just come back from Dayton, And in doing research for today's, I was reading about you running the Boston Marathon numerous times, and you know you've run marathons, it seems like, all the time. When did you have to get involved with that?
Well, I was in Bethesda Naval Medical Center there, and on my bed, and it was in October. The Marine Corps Marathon, it's always at the end of October, last Sunday in October. The resident and a nurse walked in, and resident was on one side of the bed, the nurse was on the other, and they said, "Hey, did you run the Marine Corps Marathon?" They were talking to each other, and she said, "Yeah, I thought I saw you," and they were talking about the Marine Corps Marathon and just how was it, you know, the great time they had, or how painful it was. And I was just listening to them, and they were just talking like I wasn't even there. I was listening to them talk and kind of like, you know, turning my head from one person to the next as I heard them talk. And then they walked out of the room, and I always was a runner, you know, in high school and college. And that's what we do in the military.
Yes.
So I said, well, you know, I don't know what the blind could do. But in my head, I said, that is the first thing I'm going to do. So the resident walked in. You know, the next time he walked in, I said, "Hey, do you think I could run a marathon?" And he said, "Yeah, absolutely." But I think he thought I was heavily sedated and hallucinating. And I said, "You know what? I'm going to run next year. I'm going to run the Marine Corps Marathon." And I don't think he believed me. I swear. I trained so hard for it. I turned my bed into a jungle gym, and I had camelbacks and elastic bands, and I doubled up on my physical and occupational therapy, and I changed my diet. And I mean, I was weighing well over 200 pounds, you know, when I made that commitment, and I'm only, you know, 5'8". So
okay.
It was a full year of starting baby steps until I ran the marathon. And I tell you what, I just caught the bug, and I haven't quit yet, and I keep on running.
But the story is really cool in a book. We're talking with Ivan Castro. His book is Fighting Blind, and I strongly encourage everybody to go out and read it. I don't, you know, whether you're in the military or not, this is just an inspirational story of how you survive and how you keep going. And I think that's, you know, one of the things that I've talked to with other veterans that have been wounded and so forth is if you get knocked down, you just get up and you keep going and you keep going and just keep it going. That's all you can do. And you've been involved in this ever since, you know, you were injured, and you've been traveling around the world. You went to Antarctica.
I did, with Prince Harry and 11 other injured veterans from, some from the U.S., the U.K., and Canada and Australia.
How did you manage that one?
You know, after that first marathon, I continued running marathon after marathon, and there was a couple of years that I think I ran like marathons back to back. You know, like three marathons, one marathon every weekend. You know,
wow.
Or 3 weeks or things like that, and. Some challenges like down in Disney where you run a 5K, a 10K, a half, you know, a full marathon, 50 milers. And then I started, cycling. So I cycled across America from San Francisco to Virginia Beach. And I just, you know, I wasn't deploying. I wasn't able to deploy, and I still had that energy that, you know, just a desire to push myself and challenge myself and really break down the walls of what people, with limitations.
Mm-hmm.
I don't consider myself disabled. I say I have a limitation. And you'd be surprised what I could do as a blind guy, you know. Things just like everyone else. I've been very blessed, Dale, from my family to my command, and folks that have been my friends throughout the years, and new friends that I've made, very blessed. But I was just received an email saying, "Hey, do you want to go to Antarctica, ski to Antarctica, fill out the paperwork?" And there was a selection, an assessment for a lot of folks showed up, and I was very blessed to be one of four to represent the U.S. to ski down in Antarctica with Prince Harry. And I've done other things for Prince Harry.
Well, I mean, you know, many people don't seem to realize that something, you know, that Prince Harry was a helicopter pilot, as his brother was as well, and, you know, spent time in the military. And I think that's where he's, you know, he's dedicated to helping the veterans of the United Kingdom as well as veterans around the world.
Yeah, great guy, has a generous heart, very humble, very caring, very kind, passionate for veterans, the families, and children. And he's got such a huge mission. And I pledge my commitment to him and the Royal Foundation and their mission. So I've been involved ever since Antarctica, helping, my last April, we had a big campaign called Heads Together, to break down the walls and stereotype and the stigma of people with mental health, So it was a big campaign in the U.S. And the UK, and we did very well, and I'm still trying to do what I can in that campaign. And now, as far as a challenge, my next event is here in June. I'm heading out to France, and I'm going to walk El Camino de Santiago de Compostela. So it's 500 miles as a pilgrimage. And hopefully I could raise the funds. I've got a GoFundMe page to raise the funds to take a team of injured vets to the North Pole. I went to the South Pole, so
might as well.
North Pole is looking kind of lonely up there.
How did you, again? You're an amazing young man, Ivan, and I'm duly impressed, probably more than I care to say. But how did you? You know, we've got about 8 minutes to go. How were you able to stay in the military? As we mentioned earlier in our other interview, that you just had recently retired last year as a major.
Yeah.
But how were you able to stay in? How did you come up with a job for yourself?
The military was all I knew and all I wanted to do in life. And when I was injured, I remember early on, I thought that was the end of my career. I had great leaders. I had great support of my leaders, all the way to the top. At the time, General Brown, Admiral Olson, I served in Special Forces. And one of the things that is said in Special Forces is your reputation starts day one. Mm-hmm. The minute you go to SFAS, Special Forces Assessment and Selection, that's when your reputation starts, and you're constantly being assessed. And right. Even though you graduate and you don't win your Green Beret, you earn your Green Beret and your tab, your Special Forces tab. I've always been a guy that I like to help others and go above and beyond the mission, there's certain things I live by, Dale, and that's gratitude. A positive attitude and surrounding myself with positive people, family, faith, and friends. And I can tell you that I've had that ever since my career in the military. And I don't know, I must have done something right that my leaders knew who I was, and they supported me. They said anything you want, anywhere. And I try to get back as close to Special Forces A-Team, SFODA, but I know that that's not realistic. So I was very blessed after I recover to go back and serve as an executive officer for a headquarters company and be a rear detachment while everybody else deployed and take care of those that passed away when they came back and family members and those that were about to go forward, And then I was able to command a Special Operation Recruiting Command, a company, and go to school like everyone else. And the great thing about it was they just treated me like a regular officer, they didn't give me any special treatment.
I've been interested. I've been hearing stories, not just yours, but from other wounded veterans who have been able to continue their service. And I have to give kudos to the military for figuring out a way of doing that. And I, I appreciate that. You are involved in many, many veteran awareness activities. Can you tell me what you're up to, what your latest is? We've got about 3 minutes to go.
Well, like I said, the next one that I have here is I have a nonprofit of my own which supports education and employment. It's called Special Operators Foundation.
Okay.
So specialoperatorsfoundation.org. And my next venture is to raise enough funds to take a number of guys or gals to the North Pole, and doing so also raising money for education and employment. So I'm a firm believer that if you have education, you can have employment.
Right.
And although you're injured, there's still a lot of things that you could do outside in the civilian sector or in the military. But right now, the next thing I think in June, this June is El Camino Santiago. Absolutely.
All right. And what was it? What was the name of that organization again?
Special Operators Foundation.
Foundation. Okay. I wanted to make sure I got that so I can put it on our website.
Absolutely. And we have a GoFundMe page, for the, North Pole Challenge.
Yeah. Okay. And, you just had so much energy. I can't believe it. To get all these things going there. You have helped a number of other veterans. We've got 2 minutes to go. You've helped a number of other veterans. I was reading an interview that you did on ESPN about another military person who had lost his sight, and you and your wife flew down to San Antonio and helped him out. His name was Tavera.
Yeah, Joel Tavera, absolutely. Yeah, great guy. He's come a long way. He's retired, and he's in school, and God bless him. He's doing good. Yeah, I believe, you know, Dale, it's the veterans of those veterans of World War II, Korea, Vietnam, that really paved the way for this generation. And, you know, it's my turn, my generation, to help the upcoming vets that are coming behind us. So, you know, I pledge my commitment to those newly injured vets and their family members, whether you're injured or not. You know, I just got a great heart. Whether you're Marine or Air Force or Army or Navy, you know, I love them all.
That is very true. As much as we have rivalries, we do get along when we need to.
It's all one team, one fight. And I always say, we train together, we fight together, we bleed together, we recover together.
We do. We do. Yeah. Ivan Castor, I want to thank you again for being on Veterans Radio. Please let me know if there's anything that we can do to publicize whatever it is that you're involved with. I think we can help each other out a little bit here. And I want to know how your trip to the Arctic and your trip to France, how they're working out.
Absolutely, Dale. Thank you so much. And if there's anything I could do for you or anyone else, feel free to get a hold of me.
I will do that. Thank you, Ivan Castro. All right. Well, The Fighting Blind is a book. I encourage you to go get that. One last plea for people that were involved with TET of 1968. We're looking for people to be on our program on February 4th. Just contact us at veteransradio.net. Next week, we're going to be talking about the VA. So until then, you are dismissed.